Hi, and welcome to Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. I'm Jeremy Wartzman.
I'm Bianca Bremen.
And I'm Lara Chan Baker.
Jackie Winter Gives You the Business is a weekly podcast from the Jackie Winter Group, which is a creative production and representation studio based in Melbourne and New York City. What originally started as a business conference for artists and fellow creatives is now being turned around to shine a light on our clients. From art buyers and creative teams to fellow producers and managers, this podcast is all about offering a glimpse into the work we do as a bridge between clients and creatives. It's an ongoing exploration of how to wrangle the creative process to achieve excellence no matter what the medium. Today, we focus on the publishing industry. We've spoken quite a bit about advertising on the show, but we haven't really delved into the publishing world. First up, we ask, is the publishing model broken? And later on, we have the wonderful Yasmin Agavi from Media Arts Lawyers back in the studio to help us take a look at royalties and break down a publishing agreement. But as always, first let's check in. Bianca, Lara, how are you both?
So good. I've been bicoastal this week. I spent some time in LA doing some meetings with clients, which was really fun. Caught up with a few of our artists there too.
Excellent. Lara?
I'm just getting over the flu, so my life's been sick. Literally sick. Good one, Lara.
Jeremy, how are you?
I'm still angry about Top of the Lake Season 2, China Girl, the worst sequel I think I've ever seen in my life. Like, I want to talk to anyone I can about this. I want people to watch it, only so we can talk about how bad it was, but I don't want people to watch it because it also is so bad. And I just, like, I keep thinking about it. I was falling asleep thinking about last night, like, how bad it was. It's really, really bad.
It's ruining your life.
I had no idea that Season 2 was even out, so...
The first one was so good.
It was incredible.
And I have such limited TV time. I feel it's really an injustice. Anyway, so we'll start, as we always do, delving into our professional development Slack channel, which has been abuzz with different links in the past week. Bianca, tell us how you really feel about Radical Candor, which is something that we've spoken about a bit. And John Maeda, who is, you know, a design legend, did a tweet about this, linking to an interview where he discusses that. B, this is something we've talked about between us, but did you have some thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, John Maeda is one of my favorite voices in design, and he highlighted this quote from an interview with Kim Scott, who is actually, she's the author of Radical Candor. I mean, she wrote the book about it, which is titled Radical Candor.
Maybe we should just outline what Radical Candor actually is for people who might not know.
Yeah, I mean, well, I'll start with a quote, which is, radical candor is the ability to care personally about the people you're working with and challenge them directly. So it's a concept that I'm really interested in. It's kind of this balance between being able to be honest with someone and not hold anything back. Jeremy, do you have a more succinct way to describe radical candor?
I mean, not really. I mean, I think it comes up a lot when you hear about Steve Jobs and how he kind of ran Apple as a manager, in terms of his philosophy of, he felt that if he wasn't giving the full and complete feedback about somebody, he was actually doing a disservice to that person, of not giving them the opportunity to grow. But then I guess the flip side of it, a lot of people found that to be quite harsh. So I think it's a really kind of polarizing tactic of management.
They talk about ruinous empathy in the thing, which is like an overwhelming fear of not being
like
kind.
An amazing death metal band.
That is our next project, Jeremy.
I guess, like, ruinous empathy. I mean, that's a behavior in which someone is trying to be nice in an effort to spare people's feelings, which, I guess by not saying what needs to be said and kind of offering like a verbal pat on the back rather than actually giving feedback that may be constructive and honest.
Look, it's an interesting concept that I think this interview is a nice kind of way into, especially picking up from our episode last week on feedback. So we'll put that in our show notes to check out. Another thing that's come up is a piece on Giphy sponsoring or testing sponsored GIFs. They've got 200 million users now, and they're now kind of starting to roll this out, which I think is pretty controversial given how, I guess Giphy has embedded in our lives at the moment.
Yeah, but I think everyone's been waiting to see how Giphy would monetize. Like, they had to eventually. So it's not a huge surprise to see that they're about to test sponsored GIFs. They haven't really clarified exactly how it's going to work yet, but the article sort of suggests, this is an article on TechCrunch, it suggests that it might work in a bit of a similar way to Google AdWords. So, a search for the word cheers might bring up a sponsored GIF of, Budweiser's clinking together or something. And something the article points out, which I find really interesting, is I guess it's an interesting development because, like sort of sponsored Snapchat filters, even though they do contain branded content, they're being sent to you by a friend, and that already makes them far more engaging to look at than a regular ad. So it's sort of a way to really embed themselves into our culture. It's interesting. We'll see what happens.
Awesome. Yeah, I think it's also going to give a new angle to how we think about advertising as well, because now I think we're going to be, well, people are creating ads now to actually kind of share in this way. So just like how, you know, John Oliver with Last Week Tonight, like the way that the idea of YouTube has crafted how they put a segment together because people know they're going to share it. It'll be interesting to see if this has a real effect where people are now making ads to be turned into actual sponsored posts. Following on from our AI segment, also just to clarify, I don't think people really understood the full AR, VR title that I put in the other week.
No, I didn't fully understand it until I read it about 5 or 6 times. But it was funny once I understood it.
Yeah, I mean, I actually thought it was a mistake.
Not a mistake.
I fell asleep on the keyboard.
Just clever use of acronyms. But Laura, tell us about this piece for coming from the ABC here in Australia.
Yeah.
Could a robot do your job?
This is cool. It's a fun little interactive that the ABC put together using a big data set from a research house called Alpha Beta. Basically, you can look up a job title, and based on the skills required to do that job and the ability to automate those skills, they'll tell you the likelihood of you losing your job or losing that job to a robot in the coming years. Luckily, producers seem pretty safe according to this.
Yeah, according to that, only 12% of the role of an arts administrator or a manager could be automated. So I think we're good. I mean, but I think that, you know, we do have like an empathetic role that requires empathetic communication.
Yeah, totally. The thing that I found really interesting in the link, though, like the interactive's fun, but through that link, you can also get to the larger report that the data comes from. We'll pop it in the show notes in case you want to have a read. But they're really pushing, if you read the report, they're really pushing the side of the argument that greater automation will mean that jobs become safer and more satisfying and more valuable, even for those in our society who are really susceptible to losing their jobs to automation. And it looks at how automation can like shift the industry and our economy in a really positive direction if we act carefully now, which is kind of the opposite perspective to the majority of news media at the moment.
Did you guys ever have to do that test in high school where, like, you know, you fill out a bunch of questions and then they say this is going to be your job in the future?
Oh, yes.
What did you get?
I actually got things that are somewhat close to what I do. Like I got journalist, or I'd get like researcher, or I also would get like athlete, which I find hilarious because, I mean, can you imagine? Yeah, what did you get?
I don't remember, but I know that there were like a few people, like they did have job titles like waste management technician, which was like literally garbage.
Sometimes I feel like a waste management technician.
Mine was actually perfect. I need to share mine with you because it was lawyer, graphic designer, performing artist.
And you're all three of those things now, Bianca,
in your own, basically
in your own small way. Yeah, so speaking of waste management, I was moving on. That was making a very funny segue to Twitter. I think I'm the one person who just has not gotten into Twitter yet.
Of us.
Okay, good.
Can't deal with it.
But, I mean, when things like this come up, this a mansplaining tweet storm, oh, my God, I don't know where to even begin with this. I like how there's like different segments of kind of Twitter groups that are kind of loosely defined. And like I think someone was saying that Design Twitter was kind of going crazy about this, which is Eric Speakerman, who is a pretty renowned he's a designer, author, font designer. He wrote one of my favorite books on typography called Stop Stealing Sheep. Anyway, Laura Kalbag tweeted out that she was promoting a book that she wrote and says, like, I've written a book, it's coming out very soon, et cetera, et cetera. And then Eric Speakerman replies to the tweet, actually, you wrote a text. It took a few other people and skills to make that into a book. And it just completely just devolved into...
a dick move.
It was pretty bad. I mean, he was kind of going into this assertion that basically, well, actually, you kind of wrote the text, but then someone actually had to typeset it and print it and bind it, and then like separating the book as an object, as this group effort.
What Twitter pointed out, she wasn't getting at the fact that she did it all by herself. She's celebrating the fact that she wrote a book, which she did.
I know. We could probably do a whole episode on all the different things that are actually kind of happening here. I guess the apex of this is that J.K. Rowling kind of eventually chimes in and gives her some support and adds to the whole smackdown.
Along with all of the rest of Twitter.
It's pretty hilarious. Crazy. I mean, yeah, there are so many things to kind of pick apart here, but it's entertaining and educational, which is a good and a bad thing. I'm not kind of sure where it falls in the spectrum.
He didn't seem to learn from it. Did you see his responses? Anyway, we'll put it there so you guys can read it.
We'll put it on the show notes. You can judge for yourself. Tell us what you you think, email us at podcast@jackiewinter.com. Again, all of these things will be in our show notes at our podcast page at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. Starting our first topic, we're going to look at publishing. Now, publishing and editorial, it's a huge area that we work in, but we haven't really kind of spoken a lot about. Up to now, we've been speaking mostly about advertising, but Jackie Winter really, and my own background, kind of came from publishing, specifically magazine publishing, and that kind of, I guess, flows onto book publishing from there. But there's been lots of questions in recent times about the sustainability of the actual model. So I thought to get started with, Bianca, you've been working in New York and in publishing for a while. Maybe explain to us a bit more about the actual kind of process of publishing as a business model.
But to break it down as simply as possible, after, you know, months of pitching or even years if you're an author or an author illustrator, if a publisher is interested in publishing your book, they'll send you an offer. And that offer will come in the form of a publishing agreement. And this agreement will generally include a dollar amount known as an advance. An advance is a sum of money that the publisher agrees to pay you in advance for you to finish the book over an agreed period of time. And as an author or an author illustrator, as it probably is in our case, you're the copyright holder. And by accepting a book deal, you're essentially granting the publisher the rights to publish your book. So the amount that the publisher offers as an advance will actually vary wildly depending on who you are and who they are. And I think the expected sales of the book, it's usually split into payment intervals. In most cases, you'll receive a portion upon signing the contract, a second payment once the manuscript is complete, and then the final payment not until the day the book is actually published. If you have a literary agent working with you as well, which most good authors or author illustrators would, your agent will also receive a cut of this payment too. And generally with a publishing deal, an author will also receive royalties. So royalties, like an advance, will vary, but they could be anywhere between around 5 to 15% of the sale of each book. And you only actually start to receive royalties once sales have surpassed the amount of the advance. So if the book doesn't sell, the author doesn't make any further income from it and the publisher loses money. And this is a risk that the publisher takes. But if it does sell and it does do well, then everyone wins. And I guess we're going to talk today about, is this the most sustainable model for publishing books?
Yeah, look, you raise a lot of interesting points there. I mean, that kind of is the meat of the process of what happens when things actually kind of get rolling. I think there's a whole process about, I guess, how do you even get to the point where you are kind of pitching a book? And I think most creatives really hold in high esteem a physical representation of their kind of ideas. I think a lot of, whether you're a designer, looking at a monograph kind of your work, or whether you're an illustrator and wants to kind of have a children's book, it's really held up on a platform in a lot of ways. And at the same time, publishers have a really interesting, you know, the actual kind of business model, I guess, is also about, there's a bit of a lottery in that as well. I mean, just like kind of a music label is a publisher of music and a book publisher is a publisher of text, there's this idea that they try to find lots of authors and they sign lots of books, and it's hoping that one of them is going to kind of stick. So there is this kind of idea that they're trying to spread around a really kind of wide variety of talent, like trying to find that needle in the haystack in a way. And I think with the emergence of so many more freelance creatives and just creatives in general, there's a lot more kind of interest in the field and a lot more people kind of approaching, I guess, how books get made and the actual business model themselves, and really kind of, I guess, disrupting that in lots of ways. And I think the reason that this came up as a topic, one, because it's an area that we wanted to get to, but two, there's a really interesting piece that came up about a restaurant, I think, or is it a bar called The Aviary?
Actually, it was about Alinea first. So Alinea is a restaurant in Chicago that's considered one of the very best in the world. It has 3 Michelin stars, and it's headed up by Grant Aschatz, who he's himself a really fascinating guy. There's a really great episode of Chef's Table about him that's very worth watching. And it's also headed up by his business partner, Nick Kokonis. So basically, Nick wrote this insane article on Medium outlining the huge learning process that they went through in publishing their first book. And this is seriously such a good read. I found it so fascinating when it first came out, and I was just as into it when we went back over it for this episode today. And basically, it all began about a decade ago when agents and publishers started approaching them to create an Alinea cookbook. And Nick was totally taken aback by how difficult it was to really assess the offers, because it's pretty much impossible to find out any real numbers associated with publishing sales and costs. And it led them down a pretty interesting path.
I guess a series of articles as well, where we're finding people getting really transparent about kind of cost and business models in general, that I think is a bit of a trend that we've been seeing, especially when we talk about different links in our show notes. So yeah, what did you find out when reading this piece exactly?
Yeah, so I guess after doing the math on the various offers, one of which he actually publishes in the article, it's really interesting, he realized that the agreements were pretty hugely rigged in the publisher's favor, and that thanks to some clever clauses in the contract, the publisher was essentially taking no risk at all, whilst the Alinea team stood a pretty low chance of making any profit from the book or even covering their costs. And the next issue they came across was a complete lack of control over the content, the design, the production process. And after creating a small prototype, they were actually told by various publishers that if they published the book their way, it would be way too expensive and it wouldn't even sell. So eventually, for the Alinea book, they struck a very unusual deal with a very unique independent publisher, in which they agreed that Alinea would be on the hook for all of the production costs, but in return, the publisher would front the costs and Alinea would get full and uninhibited creative freedom to produce the book however they wanted. And they would also get the help with the copy editing and benefit from the publisher's relationships with printers, and the publisher would warehouse and distribute everything. So the article goes into a whole lot more detail about what happened, but basically they're now in the sixth printing edition of that book with over 100,000 copies sold. However, whilst their super unconventional deal worked really well for the first book, when it came time to publish their second book for their other restaurant, The Aviary, they decided to instead go down the path of self-publishing. And that decision was largely driven in particular by Amazon's total monopoly on the book industry and the fact that, well, thanks to the internet, you no longer need the connections of a publisher to reach your audience.
And what's your take on that in terms of how, I guess, that affects the industry and the people that we work with?
Well, I guess what's interesting here is that Nick goes on to make a really convincing case for why this is a far, far better method of publication than the traditional model. And he also gives a really transparent rundown of what it took for them to do it in terms of like their time, resources, equipment, and so on. But what also becomes pretty painfully clear is that in order to forgo a publisher, you have to be willing to do the work of a publisher yourself. And that's not necessarily easy. It takes a lot of research, a lot of time, a lot of money, and a lot of talent. And I think few people have it in the way that Nick and Grant do, which they certainly do. And unless you're someone like them, I can very much see why the publisher model is somewhat necessary or at least attractive. Then again, if you do have those skills, and especially if you are looking to publish something that is a little less complex than their incredibly elaborate cookbook, we're very much in a day and age where successful self-publishing is absolutely possible, and the kind of effort and budget you'd be facing is certainly on a sliding scale depending on your audience and what you're hoping to get out of it. I think the Aviary example is a particularly interesting one because self-publishing has often been hailed as an option for those who struggle to get a publisher on board at all. It's a second option when that fails. But here you have a team who absolutely do not struggle for offers. They've instead chosen to go down the self-publishing route because they want the infinite control that it brings. And their incredible value as visionary creatives and shrewd businessmen means that they can cut costs where they don't need them and spend the time and money on the areas that a traditional publisher couldn't afford to.
Mm. Yeah, look, picking up from that, B, let's talk about your very own art crush, Mr. Bingo. he kind of, you know, he, I guess, is most famous for his hate mail project and music video, but also for the book that he recently published as well. B, can you tell us a bit more about kind of what he did and, you know, why it's so important, how that kind of relates a bit to what Laura was talking about?
Yeah, I mean, talking about, you know, having control over the process and control over your product, this is a really good example of that. So Mr. Bingo, if you're not familiar, is an artist illustrator from London, and he actually just today relaunched his website and describes himself as an artist, speaker, and twat. He was for about 15 years working as a commercial illustrator, you know, for clients like New Yorker, Guardian, Mighty Boosh, The New York Times. And yeah, you mentioned before his project, Hate Mail. While he was working commercially, he started Hate Mail as a personal project where he mailed out vintage postcards, which were emblazoned with very offensive messages to basically anyone who asked for one. And when he decided
to... It's an interesting business model.
Yeah. But I mean, that was just a personal project that I think he did did in his spare time. But when he decided to publish a retrospective of some of the postcards featured in the project, he actually decided to go down the self-publishing route and actually crowdfund his book, which some argue perhaps rewrote the rules of the publishing industry. And there's this fantastic article on Medium written by a guy called Matthew Clayton, who's a writer, publisher and editor, titled "Why Mr. Bingo Just Broke Publishing," which kind of breaks this down.
Can you tell us a bit more about the campaign, actually kind of what he did and I guess what the results of it were?
I mean, his target was $55,000 Australian dollars, but he managed to raise through his Kickstarter campaign a whopping $220,000 Australian dollars. But the most significant detail here is actually not that he raised $220,000, but it's actually the number of campaign backers was 3,732. And Matthew kind of breaks it down that under a traditional publishing model, if Mr. Bingo had sold 3,732 books, his income from royalties would have been no more than 10,000 Australian dollars. So there's a huge difference in potential earnings, which I guess if you're thinking about it from a money point of view, the traditional publishing model can't compete with. But I think the really fascinating thing about this campaign in particular is, I mean, we're big fans of Mr. Bingo here at Jackie Winter, and we backed his Kickstarter. And
what do we get in return?
Yeah, well, like, I mean, his updates, you know, his Kickstarter updates were really hilarious, but the rewards that you could get for pledging to the book were amazing. I mean, what was ours, Jeremy?
We got trolled.
We did get trolled. I actually posted
trolled for a week on social media.
We got trolled by Mr. Bingo for a week on social media. So I actually posted one of his illustrations on my Instagram. I reposted it and it said, "Jackie Winter is shit," over and over again. And my mother, who knows how much I love my job and the work I do, obviously didn't get it. And she didn't really understand the context and thought something was wrong. And she called me immediately and told me that I had to take it down. So that was pretty funny. But I mean, some of the rewards that he offered were things like getting shit-faced on the train with him, things like that.
There was like a friend contract as well that was like 5 texts per month, meet up every 3 months.
Yeah, look, as a marketing exercise, it's fantastic. And that's the same thing with the Aviary book as well. Like, that's going to be a huge bump for them in terms of sales.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's interesting because, like, traditionally with publishing, like, the publishing model will take someone who's willing to pay, like $500 and selling them a book for less than $20. Whereas with the Kickstarter model, you're kind of capturing those people that are engaged with the artist and you're able to actually be in control of the end product.
But I guess the key thing is though that they have to engage those people. So Mr. Bingo did that incredible video. And that, again, takes nuts amount of like skill and time and vision to even create a campaign that can engage that many people to make them pay that kind of money.
Yeah.
Look, I think the bottom line here is like any other industry that is kind of being disrupted, the barriers to entry are being kind of lowered and really kind of rewarding really strong independent thinkers. And I think we've talked about two examples here that kind of bypass the traditional models. But, you know, one example I wanted to talk about was people still working within those models, just using self-initiated projects as a way kind of in there. And one artist that we represent and who I talk about a lot is James Gulliver Hancock. He started a project called All the Buildings in New York, which he basically set out to draw every building in New York. And James is just one of these people. He's amazing. He stayed at my house once, and when I woke up in the morning, there was just the whole kitchen was just littered with drawings just of the kitchen, because he's a person who just cannot stop drawing. And he took
that. And they're the best artists always.
Absolutely.
Just, if they're not drawing, they're not breathing.
Exactly. And I think that, well, that's another thing I think of as well. It's like that because the industry is so competitive right now, it's only the artists and talents who really, you know, who have that just kind of built into their person.
Consistently pushing themselves.
That are the ones who kind of make it to the top. But with James, I think there's apparently 900,000 buildings in New York. I was reading, this is an interview with him in the New York Times, and he just kind of started drawing all of them. And, you know, he's done, I don't know how many he's done now, but they are definitely in the thousands. And just off the back of that idea and the name, it initially started having a morning spot on, I think, one of the morning shows in New York.
CBS.
And then it just kind of built from there. And I'm sure I'm getting the story wrong, but there is definitely some aspect where he was working with a property developer as well, drawing their properties, and then kind of did an exchange like to stay somewhere. And then that led into a book deal with Rizzoli's, and that has kind of then steamrolled. So there's now in addition to all the buildings in New York, there's all the buildings in Melbourne, all the buildings in Sydney.
All the buildings in London. Project.
Yeah, exactly. It's an ongoing project, and you know, he got a publishing deal kind of out of that. This isn't really about the specifics of the deal, but it's, I guess, more about how self-initiated projects are kind of looked at in this light, and it doesn't require the same, I guess, literary agent to kind of shop your book
again,
around.
Lowering that barrier to entry for people who are creative and are visionary.
One of the interesting things about Mr. Bingo's Kickstarter and his choice to actually self-publish his book, even though it was incredibly overwhelming and he had to, you know, do everything himself from, you know, customer service and printing, wholesale sales, all of that sort of stuff, it actually changed the course of his career. And he no longer actually works for clients. He works for himself, and he just kind of creates the things that he wants to do, and has kind of taken that same self-publishing model into the rest of his career.
Same thing with Mark Martin, who is another artist that we work with, who started with his exotic animals A through Z, started as just a small zine that he did, eventually picked up by Penguin, and that kind of steamrolled a whole kind of children's book career for him as well. So there's a lot of really interesting things happening kind of in this space. We'll post all the links on our show notes, and stick around if you want to hear more about the business side of things with Yasmin from Media Arts Lawyers. But I think that'll wrap us for now. Moving on to our second topic, we are so very lucky to have the amazing Yasmin Nagavi from Media Arts Lawyers here. Yasmin joining us as our second all-time guest here in the studio. And we're going to chat about all things royalties and publishing. Yasmin, thank you so much for being here. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me again.
It's our absolute pleasure. So you've heard us talk a bit about, you know, I guess the conceptual side of the publishing world. One of the things that I think a lot of our listeners would be curious to know would be, I guess, let's break down a publishing agreement. What does an actual kind of contract look like when you see it? You've worked with so many different publishers. Take us through, you know, the underbelly. Maybe that was the wrong word.
It's pretty well. Actually, that was the word of the day a couple of days ago. Okay, well, a book publishing agreement is a binding contract between the author and the publisher,
yep.
which grants the publisher the right to publish a single work or a series of works of the author for a fee. Being an author is not limited to being the writer or co-writer of a book. An author can actually be an illustrator or a photographer, basically anyone that can be the author of a work capable of copyright protection. As Bianca already said, you know, a publishing agreement aims to balance the investment and the risks of both parties, and it comprises primarily the rights and obligations of each party.
We've worked on a lot of different books, both, you know, together with you and also just in the agency. Is there a typical structure that a lot of these kind of follow in terms of how they are broken down that, I guess, make them different to other typical creative contracts?
No, I'd say anytime that you're dealing with intellectual property, you've got the main things that are covered. What rights are being granted, in particular in relation to the intellectual property? What's the term? What's the fee? Whether the term can be terminated. And in terms of publishing, there are unique rights that are granted, but it's still within the scope of a grant of intellectual property rights.
Now, let's talk about royalties, which is something that I guess is of particular interest to me in our business, because I think it's a real interesting model of value-based pricing, which is something that is a very contemporary topic that we're very passionate about here. But the idea of royalties is a pretty old one. Even when I think about the word royalties, I think about someone sitting on a throne and like lots of crowns and scepters, you know, that they are being lavished with. But I guess, can you give us more of a legal background of what royalties actually are, especially as they relate to a publishing contract?
Royalties are the fee, also known as the consideration payable by the publisher to the author for the right to publish the author's intellectual property. When the work is sold, lent, or otherwise exploited, the author will receive a percentage of the amount received by the publisher. The dollar value of the percentage received is the actual royalty. Typically, 10% of the recommended retail price is, you know, the royalty that you'll see. But there are different royalties for different income streams and the different methods of exploitation. As you've already identified, the industry has changed a lot, especially in the last 10 to 15 years. So there are lots of different deals being offered these days. The structure is very similar, but you know, what's being offered can change from person to person.
And royalties, I mean, you, at Media Arts Lawyers, you deal with a lot of different industries. Obviously, publishing is one of them. Is royalties a concept that you see in other industries as well?
Yes. Music, primarily.
Yep.
You'll see that in TV as well.
Yep.
But book publishing and in music, both on the music publishing as well as on the record label side, you'll see.
There's a move towards ownership with bigger businesses now. Like, the more kind of mediums that there are, the more publishers kind of want to fully own things and want to move away from royalties. Are you seeing any kind of trends or alternatives in the system at all?
Well, if you aren't offered a royalty, then you'll receive a flat fee, but the flat fee should adequately compensate for, you know, the creative output. And the thing to note, if it's a flat fee deal, what you receive is not going to change no matter how successful or unsuccessful the work is. And with royalties, at least there's a potential upside that you'll see beyond what a flat fee payment initially would have been.
Yeah, look, I think it's a great model because everyone has a bit of a stake in it. A publisher is always going to outflank an individual creator in so many ways. And I always think that contracts are typically just a starting point. You know, everyone's always kind of hedging their bets in this kind of way. The first thing that you always hear a lot about is an advance, which Bianca mentioned in her overview, is literally just that. It is an advance on the royalties. And we start getting into a bit of thorny language when publishers kind of talk about this, again, to weigh things in their favor. While there's no substitute for having a good legal counsel to actually kind of go through a contract that we always recommend to everybody, I think there are a few words and terms that we would suggest kind of people look out for. Are there any specific ones, Yaz, that you see kind of come up that typically can throw people for a curve that might be helpful to lay out here?
Yeah, well, Bianca mentioned the advance before. And so as she pointed out, the advance is the sum of money paid in advance of the author receiving royalties from sales of the work. If an advance is paid to an author, the publisher will usually retain all the author's royalties until the advance has been earned back, or also known as recouped. One of the misnomers is that, you know, you should be receiving a massive advance and not concerning yourself with the royalty rate that you're receiving. But the point is, the advance is used against what you're actually going to receive from royalties. So you should be keeping your eye on the prize in terms of what the overall royalty rate is if you have a pretty fair idea as to how many of the work will be sold.
Interesting. And I guess that comes down to the core question that a lot of people don't have a lot of confidence about, which is, you know, how do you know if it's a good deal or not? Like, are there any industry bodies that set standards here, or how do you kind of do the calculations? Like, what kind of figures do you need to see in a contract? Like, will they kind of stipulate a print run, or how do you kind of limit things, or, you know, what kind of points are there to negotiate on to make sure that it really is a fair shake for both people involved?
It depends on who the author is, what sort of leverage they have. If it's first-time author, whether they have a significant profile in other areas or industries, to determine whether it's a good deal or not will obviously come down to the leverage of the parties. As you said, it's always important for a lawyer to, you know, read through an agreement, or a good friend that might be a little bit, you know, more astute in these sort of things. But with every contract, you should be able to understand its contents, in particular the obligations placed and the rights afforded to you. Everything that the publisher has promised to you in your offer should actually appear in the publishing agreement. But what you really need to be careful of is what else is in the publishing agreement outside of that offer. To know whether something is a good deal, you should have a grasp of what your actual value is. If you're an established author, you're going to expect certain levels of an offer. If you are an emerging author that doesn't have much profile, the offer that you're going to receive is not going to be as generous of terms as, you know, a more established author.
But how do you judge that? Is there any, like, what are the kind of standards there?
Well, in terms of the actual offer and the royalties, so
is a lawyer able to kind of judge that? Like, are you able to give that kind of advice if, like, you're someone who, like, sees a bunch of contracts and you could say, like, look, from my experience, this is
totally
kind of what's good?
Yes. Yeah. So I did that this week with a couple of clients that called in and we went through the agreements. In one case, you know, the the terms were quite generous, particularly because this was a first-time author. But the manuscript was already finished. She had significant following already. So, you know, when the publisher was looking at it, they were already pretty eager. In terms of control, however, they are pretty strict on who actually gets to retain control of the creative in the work. So the design, the cover, even the title. I've had a couple of clients with issues as to what the title of the work is going to be called when they're having discussions with their publisher.
And that's where we get into subsidiary rights as well, which I think is one of the meatiest parts of publishing contracts that I've worked on, where it can range from very loose to someone just kind of saying one or two kind of lines to different kind of schedules of items. And this is kind of where I think is really important to nut out right now, because people don't look at book projects anymore as single books. I mean, they can spin out to entire properties that involve movies, merchandise, foreign editions, all these things. And this is what the subsidiary rights kind of lay out. I guess my broader question for you, Yaz, is how do creatives individually, or even, you as a lawyer, how do you kind of keep on top of these? Like, how do you know whether a client's kind of reporting all these things, or if they sell off subsidiary rights that, you're getting them, all those kind of things.
Okay, so the question is, how do you know if your publisher is telling the truth?
Well, I mean, I didn't say that. You said that.
So I would always recommend that in a publishing agreement, there is an audit provision. It gives you the right to inspect the records of the publisher and allow you to basically inspect what activities have been undertaken with the work, how many times the work has been reproduced, how many times it's been sold, who it's been sold to, what other rights have also been sold. In terms of subsidiary rights, these are the secondary rights outside of the primary right to publish the book. And in a lot of cases, subsidiary rights are subject to the consent of the author. So if there is a subsidiary right to adapt the work for film or TV, that could be subject to the author's prior written consent.
I think one of the points that you raise as well, which is really interesting, that we didn't actually talk about, Bianca, in the actual process, where before you even get the contract, there's kind of the offer, and the offer has to kind of carry over to the contract. And I've seen cases where things are discussed over email or verbally, and then they give you a contract and it's boilerplate, and they sometimes, honestly, or maybe sometimes not, forget to kind of put something in, and that can change the whole nature of the contract. If you've seen, Yasmin, things be litigated or people having taken action against each other because of a contractual issue in a book, what have you found to be the points that are often contested?
Generally, it's about the royalties. So whether they've been paid. So generally, you'd look at the royalties that are coming through, the reports. If you have a suspicion that the amount of books that are being sold on the report is less than what the actual sales are, there are methods and ways that you can, do a preliminary check. So you could go through BookScan, for example, to figure out how many books have actually been sold through retailers, to get an estimation of whether the reports that the publisher is sending through are accurate. If you have a pretty strong feeling that that what the author is telling you is false, then you would rely on those audit provisions. And it's only really after an audit that you would establish whether you have some rights there in terms of collecting some royalties, or whether the work is actually out of print. You'll also know whether the book is out of print if the royalties seem to dry up and they say that they're not printing anymore. Often in publishing agreements, there should be a reversion clause, which gives you the right to terminate the agreement in the event that the publisher does not agree to republish or make the book available for sale. Where that becomes complicated is in the world of ebooks and online distribution. Mm. So that clause is becoming harder and harder to rely upon. So that's why you need to be careful with your wording in terms of the reversion clause. But in terms of fights, they usually happen during the negotiation stage of the contract, where they have seen the offer and they're like, great, great. And then when they read the fine print, realizing that, oh, okay, no, the publisher actually wants to have control over, you know, the style of the photographs of, you know, during the shoot, and who's going to pay for that, and, oh, they want me to do this and this and this. And those things can easily be discussed with the publisher. So at that point, it never really turns into a dispute. That's part of the negotiation.
Awesome. Laura, you look like you have something to say. You got your hand raring up there in the corner. What do you got?
I just wanted to say, Yaz, in the Alinea article talking about that book, one of the issues they realised with the offer that they got, the one that they published in the article, which I think a lot of people wouldn't have picked up on, was that there was an agreement in there about, it was a clause, I think it was like a buyback clause or something, where the Alinea team sort of had to agree to purchase a certain amount of books from the publisher. And when they did the math, they realized that that actually covered like the advance amount, whatever. So like the publisher was basically completely covering all their costs already just through the buyback. And I was wondering if that was something that comes up, or if there are any other sort of little things like that that you sort of need to look out for.
Well, that's pretty cheeky. I haven't read that offer yet, but I will do so after the show. It depends on the nature of the agreement. If it is really a distribution deal as opposed to a publishing deal, that might be the case. So, you know, there is a difference between the two. A publishing deal obviously involves a lot more effort from the publisher in terms of editing and whatnot, whereas a distribution is... It's mostly just the pressing and the distribution of the work. If the author has a significant following online, it's useful to know whether there is a provision that allows the author to sell directly to...
That's interesting. I've never thought... No, because I just like... I guess that's how things are changing now. Like I would probably not have thought of that a year ago.
Well, that's where the leverage is.
Yeah.
And then there are other issues along with that, but I'm not going to disclose all my secrets.
Yasmin, if people want to learn more about you or, you know, want to hit you up more about royalties, where can they find you?
I can be reached on email, yasmin@mediaartslawyers.com. That's Y-A-S-M-I-N, no E. And our website's mediaartslawyers.com.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Yasmin.
Thanks for having me.
Wrapping up, as we will every week, is the most Melbourne and New York thing that we've seen this week. We thought maybe, Yasmin, you could stick around to let us know maybe the most Melbourne thing that you've seen. So some examples. Last week we had the flesh-eating mites in the beach.
Yes, lovely one. Yes. We had a while ago the man bun hipster who got stuck in the decorations at the cafe.
That was really good. Yaz, have you seen anything that's come across your desk in the north side of Melbourne?
No, I can't think of anything. I bought a house. That was the most
Melbourne thing. That is not a Melbourne thing. No one in Melbourne can buy a house.
You're obviously not a millennial.
No, I'm part of that other generation between millennials and Generation X.
Is the avocado toast a New York thing at all? Like, is this a global phenomenon of no house buying because of avocado toast buying?
Oh, I think the phenomenon came here, and we definitely have avocado toast, but it's kind of more like guacamole on toast. But I think there's bigger issues than buying breakfast here.
Maybe you can tell us what your New York thing is from this week.
Well, the entire city of New York shut down around 2 p.m. today, and everyone wandered outside to catch a glimpse of the solar eclipse. So that was the most New York thing. I mean, Americans love getting on board. They love a spectacle. You actually couldn't buy the glasses that you wear to look directly at the solar eclipse because everyone was so into this that they sold out by Saturday.
Amazing.
Did you see the picture of Trump just looking at it anyway?
Oh, yeah.
Like he just completely ignored it.
Okay. I think with that, we'll shut this down. Thank you, everybody. Go. This has been Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. Jackie Winter Gives You the Business is a weekly podcast about creative project management and production and just making things happen in general. Our producer is Arij Noor. You can find the Jackie Winter Group on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Jackie Winter. That's Jackie with a Y and Winter like the season. You can email us with any recommendations, feedback, questions, or comments at podcast@jackiewinter.com. Archives of all of our shows and show notes can be found at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. And you can also sign up to our weekly newsletter at tinyletter.com/jackiewinter to get all of our show notes in your inbox each week the day that the show is dropped. Our theme music is by Melbourne-based musician Jackie Winter. You can check out his stuff at soundcloud.com/Jackie Winter. If you like what you hear, you can really help us out by subscribing on iTunes, rating us, and commenting too. Details are on our website at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. Thanks for listening. Catch you next week. Bye-bye. So she holds a flame, but it's just cellophane blowing in the wind. Thank you, Bianca.
Thank you.
Who are you thanking?
Thank me.
Thank you, Laura.
Thank you.
Wait, we're not following the script again. Are we? This happens all the time. Why can't we get this right? It's the last thing.
Like, what's wrong with me saying thank you?
But we're giving each other names. Thank you, Bianca. Thank you,
thank
Laura.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Thank you, Bianca. Thank you, Laura.
What are we doing?
Jeremy, thank you're not following the script.
Okay. Thank you, Bianca.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Thank you, Laura.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Thank you, Yasmin.
Thank you, Jeremy.
So Jeremy gets three thank yous and we get one each.
I feel this is a bit much.
I feel like we're sister wives.
Okay,
or something.
We need to come.
Jeremy's angels.
Fuck this. This is horrible.
Thank you, Charlie. We're coming up.